time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Once again, good morning. For a Thursday morning, I'm Jack Dawes, and we're in the studio today after a great day yesterday at the Yorkton Exhibition. On the program today, what does the crop report say? Well, it says about normal crop development. The 4-H kids rock the exhibition. And climate science, myths about ice, and what about climate-contended court cases? We hook up with Dr. Tim Ball to talk about his day in court. Well, before we get to some of those stories and our reports from the Yorkton Exhibition, according to the crop reporters, the crops pretty much province-wide overall are in their normal stage of the development for this time of year. However, there are some crops that are behind due to moisture issues. 26% of fall cereals are in the dough stage, while 9% of spring cereals are in the heading stage. 2% of flax, 30% of canola and mustard, 30% of pulse crops are flowering. And as I drove in from Salt Coast just now, came by a beautiful yellow field of canola in blossom just east of the city on 16 by Yorkton Creek. So that means the ladies over at the Chamber of Commerce and the tourism booth will be getting lots of inquiries from people as they stop in and take a look at crops of the parkland that are growing right nearby, a demonstration there. Well, for here in east central Saskatchewan, as elsewhere, haying is well underway. It's now estimated about 12% of the hay crop is cut and 4% baled or put into silage. In other words, just nicely started. Some of the crop is rated excellent. About 46% of it is thought to be good, so there could be a fairly decent hay harvest. Now, in the past week, rain this week, small amounts in most areas. Holdfast area got 21 millimeters. Kelvington, only a millimeter. They had the most precipitation since April 31st, though, in Kelvington at 138 millimeters. And we continue to hear anecdotal reports from farmers, both at the last week at the Farm Progress Show and this past week, yesterday, talking to farmers over at the Yorkton Exhibition. So the crops are proceeding on, but topsoil moisture is rated as just 1% surplus, 63% adequate, 32% short in this district. Hayland and pasture topsoil moisture is rated as 1% surplus. So I think probably pretty much on average, as you might say, for this point in July. It seems like early July still, but moving on, there's all kinds of crop field days coming up, including here in the Yorkton area, just south of Yorkton, next week on Thursday, 1 week from today. The Parkland Regional College East Central Research Foundation Information Day is happening there. So that's just one of many that are upcoming. Well, for 12 years in a row now, Yorkton Dodge has been the top bidder for the Grand Champion Steer out of the Yorkton Regional 4-H sale. On Wednesday, the bid was $8.10 a pound on a steer shown by Ray Al Kazmar of Newdorf 4-H Beef Club. These days, Rayal's steer is classified as club, a sort of composite breed. In the pre-show listing, Rayal's steer is listed at 1,300 pounds. At sale time, it was 1,256. So, based on that number, Yorkton Dodge will be coming up with about $1,025 for that animal, which could be a record high for this sale.
Well, tell me about the steer a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
I bought my steer in the fall, and I bought him from Mark Pillar.
He's from where?
From Mark Pillar.
Okay.
And he's out of Monopoly, and then his dam is Mercedes-Benz, which is a Maine cow.
So what did you see in it that you liked?
He was just overall the most complete steer, and he was one that was going to make it to finish out nicely, and he's got a lot of hair. And
so when you cattle people say he's a complete steer, what do you mean by that?
Just overall, when you look at the steer, when you look at them from shoulder to hip and their depth of body and how well they balance out their, if they flow through their, from their hip down. And
so do you mind if I ask you, what age are you right now?
I'm 15.
So you've been doing 4-H since when?
It's my third year, so not very long, but I've learned a lot over the few years that I've been in it.
How do you feel about winning today? Dumb question, I realize. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm extremely happy.
Is it going to be tough to see this steer go?
Yeah, definitely. He's quite a puppy.
What's his name?
His name is Ted.
Okay. Family life. Are you here with your parents today?
Yeah, I'm here with my mom.
What's her name?
My Char.
Okay.
My mom and I, we run about 80 purebred Black Angus cattle, and we have about 100 commercial cattle.
And so where is the farm?
Mile west of Grenfell.
Okay. So what are your other interests, if I could ask you that?
I ride, and I have a cutting. I ride cutting.
Yeah.
And I work for a cutting horse trainer.
So do you see agriculture and horses and cows in your future?
Yes, definitely. I don't know. I can see myself always living on a farm.
You go to school in Melville?
In Grenfell.
In Grenfell, I see. Okay. So are you in grade 11, grade 12?
Yes, I'm going into grade 11.
Okay. So, any ideas on future studies or anything like that?
No, I really haven't planned a whole lot out.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Good luck. Nice to meet you. Nice job. Thanks a lot.
My discussion with the grand champion owner of the, of Ted, the grand champion steer at the Yorkton Regional 4-H show on sale yesterday. And you know, I was just thinking as that was playing, it's really too bad just to bring you the highlights from an event like that, watching those kids, how hard they worked all day in the ring yesterday, showing and preparing and helping each other out. Several people pointed out that it was just really good to see. Now, the reserve champion steer was from Kaya Simpson of Good Spirit 4-H Club, also described as a club animal, selling at $375 a pound to Parrish and Heimbecker of Yorkton. 72 steers sold under the hammer of auctioneer Ryan Hurlbert of Saskatoon Livestock. Formerly, he told me he cut his teeth auctioneering with Heartland Livestock here in Yorkton. Judge Lance Leachman of Maidstone did a good bit of teaching as he explained his decisions to the 4-H kids and their parents, grandmas, grandpas all assembled. Here's a sample.
And I think every steer's got a pretty good opportunity. So in the first class, the red steer, I really muscular look to him. He's got quite a nice profile because he's so level. He's long and attractive out of his hip. The calf that came second in that class with the lighter weight calves, he actually was a little bit more mark ready than most of them, you might say, because he handled softer over his rib, a little bit more flesh down into his loin. In the second class, a steer that maybe you wouldn't expect in terms of phenotype that initiated that calf there, you know, lady showing, but in that class, he actually was really, really unique in terms of the way that he handled down his top. He's so much more muscular behind his shoulder and fresher over his loin edge, maybe some other things phenotypically that are a little bit different than steers in this lineup, but he was a carcass steer in that particular group. Calf that comes in next, red steer, very similar type. He was one of the steers in that particular class that was also a little bit more near his optimal endpoint, a little bit softer to touch, and had just a high quality look as far as his balance, his structure, and having some body and dimension to it. And then you got into the three middleweight classes, what I would call the middleweight classes, and I thought there were really nice class winners and second in classes throughout those particular divisions. The young lady that's got the steer that's third in the lineup right now, it's just very practical. I love the way that he gets out on his lower joints and moves with relative ease. He's a big bodied steer, he's muscular enough down his top, comes out of his hip with some quality and look, and it's soft to the touch and really fall down into his flank. So I think he's a really complete fault-free steer that did a nice job.
That again, the livestock judge for the show yesterday, Lance Leachman, he says the club variation is a type of crossbreeding in use for show-type animals.
kind of a particular line or group of cattle that have been bred for characteristics that tend to be appealing from a show standpoint. So they can be a culmination of different breeds. They're not one breed themselves, but more of a composite in a lot of cases. And typically those cattle have more muscle, more hair, more bone, and a very neat look to them that tends to lend itself to being successful from a steer show standpoint.
So this, I gather, is all part of the way the beef industry rolls these days.
That's what they're trying to do, is trying to, just like a good commercial crossbreeding program would do, or purebred breeders even within their own breed, trying to find the animals or the sires and dams that would blend the best mixture of characteristics for the successful progeny that they're going to have.
So again, 72 steers sold yesterday. Another first for the exhibition featured the sale of 7 market lambs, including a high seller. He was Spike, a 75-pound lamb sold by Hudson Chesney of Hilltop Club. Heartland Livestock paid $475 for that animal. Now, earlier in the day, the grand champion heifer was shown by Tolan Frick of the Goody 4-H Beef Club.
Well, she was an exhibition heifer for us in the fall, and she won second in her class, and I decided to bring her to 4-H for one of my show heifers.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think is special about her?
Well, she's really good. She has nice depth of body. She's really a good finished heifer, and she's smooth all the way through her body.
So did you pick her out yourself?
Yeah, me and my sister were kind of having a war over who got the heifer, but I ended up winning, so.
When you say an exhibition heifer, what does that mean exactly?
Well, in the fall, it's a big cattle show in Regina that happens at the exhibition grounds there, and it's just a big event. It's one of the biggest cattle events in North America, so it's a big event, and she just did really well there, so I decided to bring her here.
How many years 4-H for you?
I've been in it for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm. What age are you now?
I'm 16 years old.
Yeah. So have you been here every year or through that period? Or?
Yeah, I've been here for pretty much every year. I missed a year there for a bit. I missed the 1 year, but then I rejoined again, and now I'm back here.
Yeah. So you're 16. Are you graduating from high school or have graduated? Or?
No, I'm still, and I'm going into grade 11 in the fall.
Are you seeing a future in the beef cattle industry for yourself, or do you know yet?
Yeah, I'm not too sure quite yet, but it's definitely something that's up there on the charts. So, yeah.
So what are your other interests that might distract you?
Oh, trades and stuff like that. I'm really interested in welding and construction and other things like that.
Yeah. So you actually go to school where?
I go to school in Melville. I go to Melville Comprehensive School.
Your family farm operation, tell me about that.
Well, we've been going for ourselves. We've been going for about, we moved out there in 2003, and we've been growing our herd ever since then. I started my own herd when I was about 10 years old, and I'm calving out 10 cows this year in the winter, so it's been a big step for us since we started.
Okay. Thanks for your time. Congratulations. So that again, Tolan Frick of the Goody 4-H Beef Club. Here's a bit more from the show judge, Lance Leachman. All right, so you are Lance Leachman, and your Maidstone, is that your home territory?
Yeah, Maidstone, just about 30 miles east of Lloydminster, Saskatchewan.
And what do you call the operation?
Our farm is called Big Gully Farm.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in 1967 for purebred cattle, and we still have purebred polled and horned Hereford cattle.
Right. So, Lance, when you see a class coming into the ring, can you... Do you pretty much know when they walk in what your choice is going to be?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of times I think with many things in life, your first impression is one that you can always trust, and it's the same with cattle. A lot of times the first thing you see is a lot of times what needs to be saw, and you can kind of formulate an opinion, and if there's small differences, you can look at those with more detail later.
I notice you use the term structure. What does that mean to you?
Structure is just a culmination of factors that, based on the skeleton and the animal's ability to cover ground and be functional throughout their lifetime. And cattle are ones that are always out on big pasture or range compared to some other species that are confinement. So it's really critical that cattle be good structured so that they can last long in a herd and be productive for a long time.
Yeah. You talk about movement.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing. It all ties together. So a lot of animals that are maybe extreme for other characteristics, it can impede the structure that they have. So a lot of times animals that are kind of optimal for a set of traits are going to be as long and lasting and as productive as what anybody would expect them to be.
So in your final comments here, it's obvious, I guess it's obvious anyway, but 4-H is a character building exercise?
Absolutely. There's so many different variables to 4-H. You have to work as a team when you come to a show like this within your club. You have to basically get along with so many other kids, but there's also an individual aspect where you have to work on your own animals at home or with your parents. There's so many other characteristics as far as public speaking or money management. So I think just the variety of different skills these young people develop through 4-H is really exceptional and exceeds a lot of other activities they might be involved in.
Now, I understand that you went to the U.S. for high school studies?
Yeah, I went to a junior college for 2 years and then a university for 2 years and then another university for a master's degree for the following 3 years. And I thought it was an excellent opportunity to get away from home and see how production circumstances varied in very different climates and areas throughout the different country.
So that was the motivation for that kind of move?
Absolutely. Just to learn from some people that were very skilled as far as livestock evaluation and to be able to learn from instructors and professors that had a keen interest in agriculture and had tremendous success, not only from an academic standpoint, but also people that had their own herds and were very prolific at breeding great cattle.
That, again, a conversation with an excellent young man, the judge at the 4-H show yesterday, Lance Leachman. Enjoyed his conversational style. It was really neat to see him interact with the kids in every class, and made for a great day. Now, the Arcton exhibition director who pulls all this together is Craig Boak. Credit where credit is due.
We're very fortunate with the businesses and of Yorkton and the communities in the outside area that they do support this 4-H movement, and the kids greatly appreciate how much support they do get. And it doesn't come without leaders and volunteers going out, and they do canvass the area and try and raise the sponsorship and get them to come out and buy animals, and of course there's also local grandma and grandpas and aunts and uncles that come and buy an animal for the Deprees, and we also do have local area residents that realize that it is good beef, and they're, the last few years we have been selling more to the freezer.
So again, yesterday, a couple of firsts, really, and probably a high seller record with that grand champion we talked about, and the sheep. I thought it made for a really interesting and excellent kind of a day as the show keeps evolving. Now, while we were following the 4-H show, other things were happening. We'll get to things, some of that a little bit later. Short Lines buying up some of the hopper car fleet. And we'll check in with Dr. Tim Ball at the bottom of the hour on some current climate science issues, mythology, if you like. And stay with us. It's On the Land from the Rock. I'm Jack Doz.
When you
wishing for better TV? With Shaw Direct Satellite TV, there's no need for a shooting star, because getting beaming access to up to 135 HD channels is easy. Get 1 month of free service plus free installation and no contract just by signing up. What more could you wish for? Shaw Direct Satellite TV. Call 1-855-688-6651.
The Rock Business Guide, featuring these rock solid businesses.
Safety on the road is a must. Value Tire offers the largest selection of tires in Yorkton, and their automotive technicians will service your engine, keeping it up and running. Plus, they'll do SGI inspections. Value Tire, Highway 10 East Yorkton.
A better sleep starts at Modern Mattress in Yorkton, the home of the 65-night comfort guarantee, along with Eastern Saskatchewan's only low price guarantee, locally owned and operated Modern Mattress in the former Liquidation World building on Livingstone in Yorkton.
The Rock Business Guide, featuring these rock-solid businesses.
I'm pregnant. I have never felt so lost. I can't be pregnant. I can't be pregnant. Somebody help me.
You're bringing a life into this world, but you're not ready. You just want someone to talk to. Birthright is on your side. No judgment, completely confidential. Whether you need a free pregnancy test or just a shoulder to lean on, we're here for you 24-7 every day of the year, and all our services are free. Birthright, 1771 Rose Street, Regina. Call us toll-free at 1-800-550-4900 or visit birthright.org.
This message is brought to you by St. Gerard's Roman Catholic Church and Parkland Right to Life.
Whatever summer plans you have with your family, make sure you include a break at the Days Inn and Suites in Yorkton. 74 modern guest rooms, a unique family-friendly water slide with catch basin, competitive team rates, minutes away from the best shopping and restaurants in the Parkland, meeting facilities, fitness center, and free high-speed internet. And you can bring cuddles. So this summer, make your family break special with a stay at the Days Inn and Suites Yorkton, next door to the Parkland Mall. Call them at 306-782-3112.
For the latest in farming technology, plan to visit Ag in Motion, Western Canada's outdoor agriculture expo and demonstration event, July 19th to 21st. Located on farmland just 15 minutes west of Saskatoon on Highway 16 near Langham, Ag in Motion showcases demonstrations and displays of the latest crop and equipment technology. It's the best way to see it all. Ag in Motion, see technology, touch innovation, be empowered. To learn more, visit aginmotion.ca.
If you're looking for an exciting camp to send your child to this summer, look no further than Good Spirit Bible Camp. GSBC has been serving the area since 1958, and they offer a ton of fun activities, including horseback riding, paintballing, BMXing, RC cars and crafts, plus canoeing, a shooting range, low ropes course, wilderness survival, and so much more. Offering camps for kids of all ages and families, too. Register now at gsbcamp.ca before camp fills up and you miss an awesome opportunity to be a part of the GSBC experience this summer.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
Well, every reporter has its sources, and one of my great sources when I'm searching for history is Sheila Harris, a longtime member of the Yorkton Exhibition Association. And I had a chance to chat with Sheila about some of the history. Yesterday, I think we were saying, was the 135th annual fair. And, of course, some jokes were made about me being at the first one. And, of course, I was there before that. Now, Sheila Harris told me that she moved here with her family in 1945. Her dad was in the Navy. Later on, he worked at what was known as the Yorkton Power Plant. They lived out in B.C. while her dad was in the Navy. They came back home here. And, well, Sheila, as a young girl, has some memories about the fair coming. And one of them that she wrote was that, I remember going to Cowan, Horn, and Huchen offices to enter a tinted photography contest at the fair. So I wanted to know what that was all about.
And you say you remember going to Cowan, Horn, and Huchen to enter tinted photography in the fair. Why did you have to go to a lawyer's office to enter photography at a fair?
Well, Tony Draftanza was their secretary, and she also took entries for the Yorkton Exhibition because they didn't have a full-time secretary, and she just looked after things at that time, and that would have been 1947, because I know they hired somebody by the 1950s.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So it says tinted photography. Was that what you were doing, photography?
I did that when I lived out in B.C. during the war. My cousin, Russell, and we stayed with them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He was a photographer, and he did all his own photography, developing and enlarging and everything. And he also was the one that taught me how to tint photographs. And you bought these photography tinting paints in little tubes, and then you used almost like a Q-tip, but I don't think we had Q-tips.
Not likely.
No, but I'm not that old. And then you put this on the, and it had to be matte finished photograph. And you tinted the photograph.
Right. So this would be one of many classes of arts type things that you could enter.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I did a little bit of tinting for Avalon Studio when I came back on a kind of a part-time basis.
So what I'm getting at here is the evolution of the fair. And, of course, at that time, these school and home crafts and so forth were a major part of the fair.
Yes, they were a big part. The schoolwork, the knitting, the baking, the canning, everything. There was everything. And then they did branch out. Around the time that I probably entered this, into having photography and a little more artwork for people. Yeah.
So why did all that has slowly kind of gone away from virtually every fair? What, did people just get too busy? What are your thoughts?
Oh, my thoughts are, in the days of modern society, we don't can anymore.
Yeah.
We don't bake bread anymore. We buy everything. You know, I mean, I would say, though, in the last quite a few years, since people are getting into healthier eating, they are going back to canning and to baking their bread and grinding their grain and doing all kinds of things like that. Because at the fall show, at the Harvest Showdown, they do have... Now they've brought back some of the canning and some of that kind of women's work, we call it.
Well, I want to ask, you were a female director, which was unusual at the time, but I'd like to read something here from that you've written about the fair in those days. Now, you said, well, first of all, you had to go to the CN station between Victoria and Myrtle to watch the world's finest fair, unload the rides, et cetera, and move them to the fairgrounds. But then you go on to say they hired local trucks and labor. In those days, the carnival people were all considered crooks and rather grubby in their appearance, no rules or dress code. So there have been obviously some changes for the better.
Oh, there was. But that took a long time.
Yeah.
And it must have been in the late 50s when the exhibition throughout Canada formed an A-class fair in the big cities, Winnipeg, Calgary, you name it, Vancouver, and then a B-class fair, which Yorkton, Prince Albert, and some of that size city, and then a C-class fair, which was the very small fair. So they were the ones that began putting in better rules and hiring probably more reputable midways. And yes, it all started to get cleaned up in the late 50s and 60s. And yeah, there was the Mighty Thomas shows.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so let me read you a little bit more here then. The shows, Freak, Girly, and others, seldom presented what was painted on their banner lines. Most games were fixed, the food was often doctored, and the ticket sellers on each ride or attraction were mostly shortchange artists. But people went anyway.
Oh, yeah, they went anyway. And I would say that when I was a teenager, going to the fair in those first few years, we didn't think about that much. You know, and of course we weren't allowed, we did go into the freak show, they'd have a horrible great big fat man or a fat woman or some, and they had the largest Holstein cow I remember in the world, and you know, we'd pay to go in to see those.
You didn't go to the girly shows?
No, we weren't allowed in the girly show, but the men did. The men, at the last night of the fair, it was tradition. The men always gathered, and they put on a special show in the tent for the director's special girly show.
I see.
Yeah.
And that was just for the directors, or were the public?
No.
Public
that was
men,
after
no,
everything
that
was
shut private
down.
Deal.
That was part of the deal. And, of course, these girlies were something to behold.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
No, I don't.
No, that's fine. So,
part of a great conversation with historian Sheila Harris, and a good friend, and always has some great insights. And of course, things have changed. Another day we'll let you hear the conversation, of course, when she first became a lady auxiliary member. You had to be sponsored and be of good character and all that good stuff. But just part of the color. This, of course, being Canada 150, and this was the 134th, or is the 134th Yorkton Fair. Just a little slice of history for you there. It's On the Land from The Rock, and just shifting gears ever so slightly here, we're going to connect up now with Dr. Tim Ball, who's in Victoria, and I think we have Tim on the line now. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Jack.
Good. How did you enjoy that retrospective of the Yorkton Fair?
Oh, I think that's marvelous. And one of the things that Mackenzie King said, that Canada's problem was too much geography and not enough history. And I don't agree with him. We got lots of geography and lots of history. The problem is most Canadians don't know much about either one. And these sorts of programs help them. And it's also, by the way, I think a very much a measure of a nation's maturity as it becomes more aware of its history.
Right. And speaking of which, now, Tim, Tim Ball is in Victoria, and I've asked him to be a guest today for to talk about a couple of things. We always, of course, talk about climate, weather, and climate science. And two things, Tim. You've been involved in some court cases. There's been some action and a decision there. I want to, because of your stance on climate change, I want to get to that. But there's also some new numbers out, I think, about Arctic ice. What's that about?
Well, what's happening, and of course, this is the distortion. They talk about fake news. There's been, you can have fake news in not only in terms of deliberately fake news, but also in terms of what the mainstream media choose to report. And it can create a distortion or a fake image of the world. And one of the things that's been going on is the cold temperatures in the north. And the ice has already started to reform at the North Pole, and that's just simply it's 2 or 3 weeks ahead of schedule. The other thing that people will have noticed, particularly across southern and central Canada, is cold temperatures, but also quite windy. One of the things that's doing, of course, is trapping the heat. And then, so they then focus on the heat in Phoenix and Arizona, all of that stuff. But when you actually look at it, they have not been setting records. In fact, it was warmer last year. But, of course, with Trump shifting things away with the dropping the Paris Climate Agreement, they've got to distort the news again. But a major part of it is, of course, as I said, the Arctic ice starting to reform weeks ahead of schedule.
So, Tim Ball, in Victoria, when you and I talk about this stuff, and the people are bombarded almost daily about the fact that, the alleged fact that the ice fields are receding, the polar bears won't have any place to live, people often ask me, well, how do you know this guy's got it right? And of course, there seems to be this almost world consensus of the disappearing Arctic. Help put that into context for us?
Well, it's a very, very legitimate question, and I get that after I make public presentations. You know, why should we believe you? And I say, I'm not expecting you to believe me. All I'm telling you is some facts. You can check them out for yourself. And then the bigger question that you have to ask yourself is, why are we not hearing these things? And part of the whole global warming issue has been the deliberate attempts to deceive people. And one of the ways that they've done this, Jack, is that they take normal events and present them without actually saying it as if they're abnormal. And when you actually put things into the historical context, and of course that's my expertise, is reconstructing past climates and understanding how much the climate has changed in the past, you see that, that what's going on today is well within normal patterns of climate. But, of course, that's not what they want to present. And funny enough, I got an email from my nephew today who's been challenging me over this. And he sent me a graph and showed me, here's the temperature going up and here's the temperature going down. And I said, yeah, one of the things you have to realize is that you can create any temperature trend you want just simply by picking the start and end point of your graph. And that's one of the things they've done. For example, they show the temperature going up since 1880, and then showing it at the highest readings today. Well, of course, because the temperature's actually been going up since 1680, but they don't tell people that. This is part of an ongoing trend. So it's akin to the mainstream media. They're at the point now where people say, "Oh, did you say that?" And I say, "No, I was taken out of context." What they're doing is taking facts out of context, information out of context, because they have a story to tell, not the truth to relate, and that's what's happening.
Well, I guess on that note, I might mention that when I did have one of those conversations recently with someone, and I asked them what their sources were, well, they had seen Stephen Colbert, the comedian, making fun of probably Donald Trump, and poo-pooing the idea, and people like you and, I guess, me, called climate deniers. Yep. So it's become accepted in that genre. But just getting back to the current state of Arctic ice then. So,
right.
Yeah, many people feel we had a cooler than normal June, and it was windy, and fit that into the context. It's part of the fact that we do get climate variations.
Yes, and as I've been talking on your program, that the world's been the temperature actually started to level off and then gone down slightly since about 1998, and they called this the pause or hiatus, and initially the people that were pushing the global warming due to human CO2 said, oh no, you need at least 17 years of record before it has any statistically meaningful trend. Well, then the 17 years without any increase in temperature came, and now we're into 21 years without any temperature increase. And one of the things that's happened is that because of Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, of course, that means he's also going to pull out all of the government funding to climate research. And all these people that have been depending on it, and this is, by the way, this is what's been pushing it, Environment Canada, we'll talk about it in just a minute. But what these people are doing now is they're trying to back off. So Michael Mann, who is one of the guys that's got the lawsuit against me, he was part of a group that published an article a week ago where they said, well, yeah, the temperature has been steady or the pause or the hiatus did occur, and that does show that our computer model predictions were wrong, that they were too warm. Well, they're only saying this now because they want to try and reestablish their credibility and keep the funds rolling in. But just to illustrate how much this distortion has gone on, in Canada, governments quite correctly give out government funding through supposedly arm's length from government agencies. So, for example, if you're in the social sciences or humanities, you get funded by SHRC, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. The scientists get it from another agency, and even medical research funding from government goes through the Medical Research Council. Well, all climate funding research money went through Environment Canada, and they only gave it to people that were doing the research that proved what they were arguing on their website. And so the whole thing became grossly distorted. But this has been going on, and as I said, now you're seeing a complete change as Trump pulls the funding. And it's the same thing as you've seen the drop in immigrants or illegal immigrants coming across the border, simply because Trump is now the president. Not that he had to even do anything, but just the fact that people were exploiting opportunities, and the minute they see that threatened, they stop doing it. And so it's a, It's a very important part about leadership, by the way.
So again, we'll just mention we have on the line with us here on the land, Dr. Tim Ball, known as a quote, climate denier, and talking about climate science or lack of it. Getting back to the Arctic the way it's perceived, it does seem to be the case that the Arctic more navigable now than it was 100 years ago?
Yes, more than it was 100 years ago, because, as I said earlier, the world has warmed up. Nobody's argued that. What we've been arguing is that whether humans were the cause of that warming.
Exactly.
And there's simply no evidence for that. It's the same thing as, you know, so then they call me a global warming skeptic. Now, as you mentioned, call me a denier, climate change denier. Well, as you know, that's the last thing I've ever denied. I've been trying to educate people to how much the climate changes naturally. That's the difference. But the with the Arctic ice, it came into focus when in Al Gore's movie, he wanted to show something that he knew people knew nothing about. So he said, "Oh, the Arctic ice is melting and the ice caps are going to disappear." And there were people saying that. Well, in fact, Gore said that all of the Arctic ice in the summertime would be gone in 2013, but that's absolute nonsense. The reality is we do have quite long-term Arctic ice records. People like Maura Dunbar, Canadian scientists who've been reconstructing Arctic ice from historic records and other geological records. And so, for example, around 1000 AD, there was much, much less ice than there is today. And, of course, you have to ask the question, how did the polar bears survive that? But in the so-called official record, and I put that in quotations because that means government record, we only started getting accurate measures of the ice starting in 1980. Now, they put satellites up in 78, but it took them 2 years to figure out what they were looking at. And since 1980, we've been monitoring Arctic ice. And it did go down for a while in the 90s, but again, we also started going back up again recently. But the other thing that we've learned, that I've known and other researchers have known, is that what's really important in the Arctic isn't just the temperature, it's the wind patterns. And the wind patterns that the farmers have been noticing around Yorkton this year, that's been a factor over the last 2 or 3 years in the movement of Arctic ice, the amount of open ice, and also the formation of the ice. But this is all, none of this information gets out to the public, as I said.
Tim Ball, I want to come back to the issues surrounding the lawsuits that were placed against you and so forth. But maybe just based on your comments there just now, it would be a good time to ask you, we're into kind of a hot spell right now. The summer fair is on, and the weather is hot. Now, the canola crops, as I mentioned earlier in our crop report, are flowering, and that can be dangerous in hot weather. What's your own particular view of how the rest of this summer period, July, August into harvest, how do you see it as from this point?
Well, I think that one of the things that the farmers are going to have to watch is that you're not going to get the hot. I mean, just to illustrate the point, they kept saying, oh, you know, this is the warmest year on record. In fact, the 1930s were warmer than today, and farmers know about that going back to 36. But right now the sun is declined considerably in its activity. I mentioned the Arctic ice. You can also look at the weather station at Eureka, where the temperature didn't get above zero until almost the 1st of July, and yet they were getting 24 hours of sunlight. And so cooler conditions will prevail. You're not going to get the excessive heat. You might get one day of the south wind bringing in some warmer temperatures, but you won't get prolonged heat. And the other thing, of course, is that with the cold and warm air sitting through southern Canada, you get the stronger winds that I mentioned earlier, and the problems of lodging of crops is going to be an issue as well. But the other thing is, watch the nighttime temperatures. One of the things of the warmer period that I mentioned was that it was the nighttime temperatures that were warming up. Now they're cooling down, and you could see that across the northern hemisphere, and so the chances of frost, early frost, are quite high.
It's On the Land from the Rock. We're here, of course, in the studios in Yorkton. Tim Ball is in Victoria. And Tim, as you know, my producer, Scott Fitzsimmons, always is a keen interest in these discussions we have. He's got a question for you.
Now,
Tim, thanks so much for being with us. When it comes to this, like Jack talked about, a lot of people ask the question, you know, why do you support this? Why do you support this? You start to see the facts, and it's different than what we've been inundated with. So it's kind of a lot of people, you know, are maybe starting to question, maybe starting to see, or maybe they're not. You mentioned something about the people trying to tell their story about why it is that they're pushing climate change or pushing the need for change because of man's impact on the environment. What is their story, and why are they trying to tell it? Because I think anytime you've got something like this, there's got to be a reason why they're Yep. pushing this so much. What is that reason?
And that's the perfect question that I'm working on answering with a series of articles and the book that I wrote. Because once you start to say, well, look, these people are doing this, and then people start to look at it and say, well, yeah, the facts don't match up here, then you raise the perfect question. That is, what is the motive? And we could do two or three programs on that, but I'll just do it very simply for you. The Club of Rome, with Maurice Strong, who most Canadians know, and all Saskatchewanites know very well, they decided the world was overpopulated. They decided that the world was using up the resources at too fast a rate, and that they had to reduce the population and also reduce the rate at which they were using resources. And they brought in they wrote a book back in the 70s called Limits to Growth. That's where peak oil came in. But they particularly identified the industrialized nations as the ones that were using resources at a faster rate than everybody else. And so Maurice Strong, in an interview with Elaine Dewar in a book called Cloak of Green, she said, well, what do you plan to do about it? And he said, well, we've got to get rid of the industrialized nations because they're the problem. And of course, you have to think about, well, how would you do that? Well, what they set up was the Agenda 21. This is a UN program that Maurice Strong orchestrated. Part of that was the climate thing. And think about this. If you want to shut down a nation, how do you do it? And it's particularly an industrialized nation. Well, if you can show that the activities of that nation are built on fossil fuels, and the byproduct of the fossil fuel, CO2, is causing runaway global warming, then you can say, hey, this is the problem. CO2 is the problem. And that right there is one of the facts that Jack and I have talked about a bit. But CO2 is only 4% of the total greenhouse gases. And yet, that's all anybody ever talks about. Farmers know that water vapor, water in the atmosphere, is a much greater control of temperature. You know, coming up to the fall now, you'll see if you got cloud cover, the temperature doesn't drop as much. If you've got high moisture in the air, the temperature doesn't drop as much. It's water vapor. It's 95% of the greenhouse effect, but that's ignored. So what they did was that they isolated CO2 as the problem. They then set up the Kyoto Protocol, which was to take money from those industrialized nations who developed at the expense of the developing nations. And you took the money from them and gave it to these developing nations in a great transfer of wealth. And, of course, in order to do that, you had to have a world government, and that was going to be what the Kyoto Protocol was all about and what the Paris Agreement was all about, that you need one world government to punish those that were successful and reward those that were not successful in a great transfer of wealth. But that's why CO2 became the problem, and that's the driving motive behind all of this. And by the way, the world isn't overpopulated by any stretch of the imagination.
Tim Ball in Victoria, and we're here in the studio at The Rock 98.5. I wanted to bring you back to these court case issues because you you've been literally slapped with lawsuits for your stance and comments you've made contrary to the, let's say, popular discussion of climate change and global warming. For starters, what were these lawsuits about? How did they come about?
Well, I've had three lawsuits. Two of them are still outstanding, one that we hope has come to some sort of resolution. I'll talk about that in a minute. The other one is I have to go to court in October, and that's a lawsuit brought by Andrew Weaver, who is the leader of the Green Party now here in British Columbia. And he brought a lawsuit against me 6 years ago. That's how long it's been dragging on. But all three people who brought the lawsuits against me, Gordon McBean, who was the assistant deputy minister at Environment Canada and a member of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Michael Mann, of course, was famous for the hockey stick fiasco, and now Andrew Weaver, who was a lead author on four of the IPCC reports. But he's now a Green Party leader, as I said, in British Columbia. The problem that they had with me was, one, they couldn't say I wasn't qualified, and two, although they tried to say, oh, I didn't have a PhD and all the rest of it. And the second thing was that I had the ability to explain to the people the complexity of the science in ways they could understand. And I honed those skills by teaching a science credit for art students for 25 years at the university. And one of the things that they've exploited is the fact that 80% of the population are basically art students and don't understand numbers or science at all. And about 20%, actually it's less than that, about 15% of the population are comfortable with math and science. And of course then it was very easy to marginalize people like me by saying, oh, he's paid by the oil companies. But then when I kept going and wouldn't shut up, they brought these lawsuits against me. They were all filed by the same lawyer in Vancouver, a guy by the name of Roger McConkie. And the first one was filed by Gordon McBean. And my wife and I sat down and said, well, we can't afford a lawyer to fight this. And I guess they knew that. But these lawsuits are classified by the law professors in society as SLAP lawsuits. That's an acronym for a strategic lawsuit against public participation. In other words, they're designed to use the law to silence people. And of course, that's completely against what the law is designed to do. The first lawsuit by McBean, my wife and I just simply said, okay, we can't afford to fight it, and I withdrew what I wrote. But then I got a lawsuit against, for something that I said against Michael Mann. And here's the stretch that they went to. I gave a talk in Winnipeg, Manitoba, about what Mann had done and how he'd done it. And then afterwards, I was interviewed about it and made a comment about Michael Mann. And within 12 hours, had a lawsuit filed in a British Columbia court. So here I've got a lawsuit from a man from Pennsylvania, American, filed in a BC law court for something I said in Manitoba. But that's the stretch that they're going on. And then, of course, within 9 days, I made a comment about Andrew Weaver after an interview with him. And 9 days, I got another lawsuit. And so I'm still fighting those last two. And that's where we are now. The latest thing with the Michael Mann lawsuit is that we wanted documents from him, and he refused to produce the documents. And so, of course, the courts consider that unfair. If you bring a lawsuit against somebody and then withhold the documents and data they need to defend themselves, then that's patently unfair, and that's where we sit now with the Michael Mann case.
So what happens next in that regard?
Well, what happens is that we've got to go to the courts and ask for a dismissal. But this is the problem with all of this, Jack. My legal bills now are up to almost $1.5 million, and thanks to enormous support from around the world, I mean, I couldn't fight it on my own. There's no way. But in one of the problems with these slap lawsuits, and by the way, they're not allowed in Saskatchewan. These lawsuits could not have been filed in Saskatchewan or Manitoba, for that matter, but British Columbia allows them. They can just walk away.
Timbal, we just have a couple of minutes left here, yeah. And I've found to my surprise that not everyone really understands when we talk about the hockey stick graphs vis-a-vis right. what you argue. Is there a short way we can summarize that? I found out within my own household, although I talk about it all the time.
Okay, well, what we know from the historic record was that it was very warm 1,000 years ago, and I mentioned earlier in the program about ice-free Arctic. But then the temperatures declined down to about 1680, and since then they've been warming up. Well, what came out in the 2001 IPCC report was this graph that showed that there had been no temperature change for 1,000 years. And then suddenly in the 20th century, the temperture went up rapidly.
That's the Michael Mann graph that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the Michael Mann graph. And, of course, the shape of it, and they called it this, and the shape of it is that you've got no temperature change for 1,000 years. That's the handle of the hockey stick. And then the blade shooting up is the blade of the hockey stick. Well, of course, that was based upon tree ring data, and tree rings don't record temperature. They are precipitation driven. The blade of the hockey stick was, they tacked modern temperature records that they had created onto tree ring data, which is scientifically completely wrong. But that graph became, as Ross McKittrick said, the poster child of global warming. But it was completely false and completely created. And when we went to Michael Mann and said, look, give us your data, give us your computer model instructions, he's refused to do it.
Timbal, with that, I have to break off our conversation. As always, the time flies, and it's a great conversation.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for being with us. We'll do this again, of course.
Yeah.
And Timbal is in Victoria. This is On the Land from the Rock 98.5. And just as a parting shot, I'll say thanks to and congratulations to all these great 4-H'ers that we talked about earlier on the program.